Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And NPR political analyst Cokie Roberts is back with us now to talk about the transition and her new book for young readers called Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation. Hi, Cokie. Nice to have you back,
Brian,
on the show.
Always good to be with you.
I imagine you thought the post-election context of your book launch would be a little different than it is.
Well, actually, I am the only person who didn't through this campaign.
Really?
I said it to you here during the year. I kept saying, folks, he's either going to win or certainly could win. And I was told over and over that I was crazy, but here I am.
Why did you think that earlier on?
Because I thought that I thought it was a change election, you know, and we certainly saw that. I looked at the numbers again yesterday when asked, you know, what was most important, judgment, experience, cares like you who can bring needed change. Change won 2-1. And out of the people who said that, 82% of them voted for Trump. So there we were.
So do you think as a matter of strategy that the Clinton campaign ignored those Midwestern Rust Belt states?
At their peril.
At their peril.
Absolutely.
But stupidly, that they should have known better?
Yes, absolutely. And Bill Clinton apparently told them that. But at any rate, regardless of that, I think in some ways it's even better to bring out this book, Ladies of Liberty, when women and young people are needing to take a look at women throughout our history who have done remarkable things.
And your book tells the stories of women from American history, most of whom are not household names.
Right.
Elizabeth Courtright Monroe, Judith Sargent Murray. Most of our listeners never heard those names until this moment, and many others. Would you say if there had been more equality of opportunity, a book like this would not be necessary?
Well, it wouldn't be necessary, but it would still be interesting because these women are fundamentally interesting. And as you well know, Brian, storytelling is what we try to do, and they all have good stories. One of the ones that I particularly like is Isabella Graham, a Scottish woman who came here to New York in the 18th century, a widow with a bunch of kids, and started a fancy girls' school. Nellie Custis went there when George Washington was president. And then started all kinds of social service organizations, including the orphan asylum that Eliza Hamilton helped her with. Eliza, who's become famous recently. And it's still
here. For having
here.
Been cheated on.
Exactly. Don't get me started. But Graham Wyndham is still here serving the children of New York, established these many years ago by these intrepid women with no legal rights and no political rights, but determination to serve the children of New York.
I think the earliest entry here, correct me if I'm wrong, is 1727, when some nuns from France established the first school for girls in this country?
The Ursulines got to New Orleans, my hometown, in 1727 with instructions from the bishop to open hospitals for the military, French military, who were the colonists there. But within, what's always amazing again about these women, within weeks they start doing other things, right? And thankfully the bishop was an ocean away and they could ignore him. So they started a girls' school, but they started at this point in our history, the early 18th century, a school for African Americans and Native Americans. Think of it.
And I think you credit a woman named Lucy Terry Prince with writing the first African American poem.
She did. She composed it anyway. It was spoken, as was, you know, much of poetry throughout history. And it was about a Native American raid on what was then the frontier, which was Western Massachusetts. And it was called the Bars Fight. But she was such a personage. And again, you know, you sort of look with wonder at these things. She was written about in the newspapers of the time. And again, we're talking, you know, late 18th, early 19th century. And her obituary talked about her as a remarkable person. Now, most women women were never in the newspapers. And to have a formerly enslaved woman there and talking about her accomplishments tells you something that about her and about the times that we really have lost over the centuries since.
How do we know, by the way, first African-American poem? It just says it like that in
the
book. But people must have been composing poems
before
that.
Probably, but it's one that has been handed down and in the anthologies of poetry that the scholars have put together.
Earliest surviving.
Right, exactly. But the other thing I do love, and this is, as you can see, it's a beautifully illustrated book.
It is. And what's your age target for this book?
Well, I'm never good about this. The publisher sort of says six up. But the truth is it's a perfectly good book for grown-ups, if the truth be told. But
I learned from it this morning.
But the pictures, Diane Good, the fabulous illustrator who worked with me on the earlier children's book, Founding Mothers, just does such an incredible job. She does a lot of research about these people. She learns about their clothes as well as their stories. And she has on the cover Sacagawea with her baby on the back. And, of course, that was incredible. You know the old joke about Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did except backwards and in high heels. Well, Sacagawea did everything Lewis and Clark did except with a baby on her back and digging up roots and finding the way. And the picture inside of her, I actually wanted to be on the cover because it shows her with a buffalo on one side and I guess a wolf or something on the other pointing the way. But the publisher loved the baby, and the baby is on the cover, and
great
it is
picture.
A cute baby.
Yeah, both those pictures are great.
But you know,
couldn't get all
one,
that on the dollar coin.
Don't start me.
What? Start you what?
Well,
a little bit.
I just keep wanting to have women on our currency, and it's going to be a while, if ever.
Cokie Roberts is our guest, and if you want to call Cokie and talk politics or talk about some of the individuals or ideas in her new book, Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And by the way, if you want to see Cokie in person later today, she'll be doing a reading and signing with this book at 6 o'clock to 7, at Books of Wonder, 18 West 18th Street in Manhattan. Books of Wonder, 18 West 18th Street at 6 o'clock tonight for Cokie Roberts.
And bring your
in
kids.
In person.
And bring your kids.
Absolutely. one more from the book, and then we'll talk some politics.
Okay.
Judith Sargent Murray. Got people talking about women's rights when George Washington was president.
She actually wrote her essay on the equality of the sexes in the 18th century and she wrote under a pseudonym, which a lot of people did. I mean, the Federalist Papers were under pseudonyms, but although everybody knew who it was. But everybody often knew who the women were, too. But she finally reached the point where she didn't want to use the pseudonym anymore because it was all so popular. She was called the Gleaner. That she wanted people to know it was her work. And even her husband didn't know that she was the Gleaner. But then when she put all of her work together in a book, she did solicit endorsements from George Washington and John Adams. And she somewhat hounded them until they...
Endorsements? Like a blurb on the back
cover?
Yes, well,
yeah, because getting things published, having an endorsement was very helpful. It still is. But it was especially helpful at the time because there was a certain amount of subscription raising. That
Does that mean it was on Washington's or Jefferson's mind in any way to have some kind of equal rights for women that weren't enshrined in the Constitution, like they couldn't vote, just to take a minor example?
Just a minor, which they couldn't until 1920. But she certainly knew them. You know, they had met her. She was a Massachusetts woman. She was very involved in the Universalist Unitarian Church. And Adams was someone she was friendly with. But she did want them to know her work, and they did write and say they had read it and found it edifying. So whether they actually believed that or not, we don't know. We can't get into their minds, and they certainly didn't act on it. But those ideas were battering around out there.
Anthony in Mount Vernon, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is my question. What does Cokie think about Ben Carson being nominated? Because I'm a veteran, and I worked And I get a subsidy for my housing because I'm a combat veteran, and I was given I never applied for it. I was given a Section 8 voucher. And that voucher is very important to me,
I bet.
I know it's very important to a lot of other veterans in Westchester County.
Yeah, Section 8 housing subsidized from the federal government is very important to veterans and very important to a lot of elderly people. We don't really know what Ben Carson feels about any of these things. He grew up in public housing. That is the most that we know that he knows about public housing. He has never been an expert on those issues and has made some statements about poverty that are somewhat disturbing, talking about poverty being a choice. I think there are an awful lot of people who would have lived in poverty who would disagree with that. So we really just don't know. But I have to tell you, that's going to be my answer to pretty much everything.
Yeah.
You know, school's out. We don't know what's going to happen next. All through this campaign, people have been asking me, have you ever seen? No is the answer. No. So whatever your question is, the answer is no, we've never seen it like this before.
And with respect to Carson and poverty and government programs, he said on this show, and he was a candidate, and many other places, that he thinks the private sector could handle poverty programs, anti-poverty programs, in many cases better than the government programs that are in place right now. Of course, with respect to Section 8, that was designed as kind of a market-based program because it is vouchers.
Right.
They talk about wanting to go to vouchers for public schools. That's considered a conservative, competition-oriented, private sector kind of program. That's what Section 8 is supposed to be.
Well, and the truth is that when they're done right, public-private partnerships can be terrific. And we know here we are on public radio. We know that. And when Jack Kemp was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, a very conservative New York congressman, but with very interesting and thought through ideas about what to do in terms of public housing, where he did marry a lot of public and private initiatives for the good of the tenants. Because the truth is, if it's all public housing, often it is not well cared for and there are problems. So to have the voucher system can be a better system. When he was Secretary of HUD, my mother was on the HUD Subcommittee of Appropriations in the House of Representatives, and representing the city of New Orleans, where, of course, there are many people living in public housing. And she worked very closely with Jack Kemp, and they were able to do some wonderful stuff together. So it's not that all private is bad by any means whatsoever. It's a question of how the program is structured.
Peter in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Cokie Roberts. Hi, Peter.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. Thank you.
Thanks for taking me on. I had a question. I just keep seeing this come up where people keep referring to Donald Trump as a change candidate. And that seems very strange to me because he seems like a pretty natural extension of the typical American social order of misogyny and racism and xenophobia. And most of the ways that he's different seem to be mostly nominal in terms of, oh, we're used to government functioning in this way, but it's going to be happening in a slightly different way. It doesn't really seem to be any significant changes in terms of our social structure or the order of our government itself. So I would just question this notion, what is it about Donald Trump that makes him such a change candidate? He seems to me more like a return to the status quo of xenophobia and racism and misogyny.
Well, of course, we've never had a president elect or a president who has never served in public office or the military. He is outside of the normal path to the presidency. And he, of course, has promised change to millions of voters who have decided that he will bring it. Whether that's going to happen or not, we just have to – it's like everything else. We're going to have to wait and see. We don't know what's going to happen.
On Peter raising xenophobia and misogyny, Trump has publicly said that anyone committing hate crimes, thinking that they have his blessing, should stop it. But he's devoted many more words since the election to denouncing Saturday Night Live, for example, which he did yet again on the Today Show this morning. I don't know if you saw, maybe you were in transit.
No, I saw the – I didn't see him, but I read the report.
Calling their portrayal of him mean-spirited. Do you think there's any pressure on him to denounce incidents like those that have taken place here in New York recently?
I think he would be very well served, or he would serve himself very well, to not only denounce those kinds of incidents, but to make some important gestures in terms of the inauguration, for instance, to invite people to the inauguration that would be symbolic. And I think that that would, you know, that there are things that he could do that would have not the effect of bringing the country together. That's hard. You know, it's going to take a while for that to happen, but would make people feel better and would send an important signal. He did fire Michael Flynn Jr. from the transition team, and apparently—
That's not the national security advisor.
No,
that's
this
his
is
son.
And the son was tweeting. Honestly, everybody's phone should just be taken away, but was tweeting about a false news story that was had the effect of becoming quite dangerous, where a pizza place in a Northwest Washington neighborhood where all the kids go, my grandkids go there, that somebody walked in with an assault weapon thinking that he was taking the law into his own hands and was going to clean up some sex ring there that didn't exist in any by any stretch of the imagination. It was just a total lie. And the danger that could have occurred is horrendous. Fortunately, no one was hurt. But this was tweeted by the son of the soon-to-be national security advisor, and Trump did fire him. But much more needs to be said and done.
By the way, some people are pointing out about Ben Carson that he didn't grow up in public housing. That's been fact-checked, and he acknowledges he grew up poor in Detroit, but not in public housing, okay. Though he says he knew a lot of people in public housing.
Oh, that was part of his story. Okay. Now yeah. It's been checked.
That's right.
Like many other things.
Philippe in Brooklyn.
I love fact-checking.
WNYC with Koki Roberts. Hi, Philippe.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Brian. I always consider your show the best in the United States, bar none.
There you go.
Yeah, very kind. You've been to every city and heard all the other shows, right?
Hey, we've heard them. They're on the archives. We listen, and I listen to yours even when we're traveling.
Thank you very much.
As I'm listening online now. And to Koki for being such an objective, you know, reporter, and thank you for all the years of service you've done. So
I
wish you many more.
I appreciate that.
The question I'm going to ask you, and perhaps we'll see you at Books of Wonder. Peter
good.
Is wonderful. I love that bookshop.
Right.
For Hillary Clinton, one of the problems was for me, I predicted, even though I was a Hillary Clinton supporter, that she was going to lose, and there were many mistakes throughout the campaign. But the main reason I said that, and I got into a lot of trouble with my white female friends, I'm African-American male, obviously, because I told them, you guys are going to hand the election to Hillary Clinton. And I've listened so many times when white females call, even on Brian's show, and I started to create these different segments as to why they were not going to vote for Hillary Clinton, including the factor of jealousy and overly ambitious, et cetera, et cetera. So, considering your book, how is this really possible that her affinity group could not see her in the White House?
Well, you're right. She lost the votes of white women. She did win married women, which is unusual for a Democratic candidate, and college-educated women, also unusual for a Democratic candidate. But but she did lose white women. And I think that was more having to do, frankly, with partisanship than with sex. But there probably was some element of that there. I mean, the group she lost the most compared to Obama was unmarried men. So, you know, we can devise all kinds of scenarios in our heads. We can't get into people's minds. And we don't even know what people – I mean, people themselves probably don't know whether they were hesitant to elect a woman president. We certainly have, you know, data that shows that there is a hesitation about that still. But whether that was the determining thing in this campaign, I would question. But it was certainly a factor, and I think that you read the book, Ladies of Liberty, wouldn't see these fabulous women from the 18th and 19th centuries and think, Good Lord, how could we be in the 21st century and still not have a woman president when we've had such active and accomplished women for so many decades?
And we're just about out of time, but Trump will be inaugurated on Friday, January 20th. The next day, Saturday the 21st, there will be what's being called a Women's March on Washington, which looks like it will be very big. Can you remember an inauguration being met by a major protest the very next day?
No, I can't. And I can remember inaugurations met by major snowstorms where nobody could get there. But if those women come in large numbers, the one thing I would encourage them to do is to have a goal. Not just show up, but show up with something in mind. Because if really there are tens or hundreds of thousands of women, that's an incredible force. And we should, you know, they should do it with saying, this is something we want to accomplish rather than just we want to show that we're here.
Cokie Roberts, NPR and ABC News, political analyst and author now of Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation. And Cokie will be appearing live this evening at 6 o'clock at Books of Wonder. And if you wonder why Books of Wonder, because you just tuned in, this is a young reader's book, Ladies of Liberty. And Books of Wonder is at 18 West 18th Street in Manhattan for a 6 o'clock reading and signing. Cokie Roberts tonight. Thank you so much for stopping
by. Thank you, Brian. Always a treat to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come. Stay with us.